You're listening to DTFHN for July 28, 2026. I'm your structurally compromised host, Jack Hacksmith. We are your daily tech feed for Hacker News, a website where engineers argue about whether the floor is lava or load-bearing. Today, the ground shifts and the old cracks reopen. Grab something bolted down and hold on. Shindo 7. That's the top of Japan's seismic intensity scale. It doesn't go higher. At Shindo 7, reinforced concrete buildings can collapse. The ground itself liquefies, and that's what parts of Kumamoto Prefecture just experience. A magnitude 7.1 earthquake struck southern Japan today, centered in a region that, and this is the detail that makes your stomach drop, is barely finished rebuilding from the last time this happened. The 2016 Kumamoto earthquakes, nearly identical in strength and location, killed 50 people and displaced nearly 200,000. Drive through the area, and you can still see cracks in structures from a decade ago. Now this. The early reports are still coming in. At least 50 people hospitalized. 9 missing. 12 house collapses. 4 people trapped. 7 fires. Multiple highway bridges snapped. Roads damaged. These numbers will change. They always do in the first hours. And historically, they change in one direction. Japan is, by any measure, the most earthquake-prepared nation on Earth. Their building codes are the global benchmark. Their early warning systems give citizens seconds to minutes of advance notice. Their disaster response infrastructure is unmatched. This is a country that engineers for exactly this scenario, constantly, as a matter of national identity. And Shindo 7 still breaks things, still traps people, still starts fires. There's a term worth understanding here. Most of the world measures earthquakes by magnitude. The energy released at the source. Japan also uses Shindo, which measures what actually happens at the surface where people live. A magnitude 7 quake might register Shindo 4 at 90 kilometers out. One Kumar living at that distance reported light shaking. Nothing fell over, but at the epicenter, that same event maxes the scale. The distinction matters because it's the difference between measuring a bomb's yield and measuring what it did to the building you're standing in. The broader anxiety here is the Nankai Trough. Japanese seismologists have been warning for years that a massive subduction zone earthquake is statistically overdue along the Pacific coast. Whether today's event has any relationship to that system is a question seismologists will be studying closely. But for residents in southern Japan, the psychological weight is real. You prepare for the big one, and then a 7.1 hits a city still scarred from the last 7.1. And the preparation starts to feel like an asymptote. Always approaching safety, never arriving. What matters right now is the rescue operations underway. 4 people trapped, 9 missing. Those numbers are someone's family. Japan's emergency response will be fast and competent. It always is. But competence doesn't undo a bridge snapping or a house folding in on itself. Some forces just exceed what engineering can hold. We talked earlier about systems under stress, systems by design. Story 2. What even are microservices? I've spent enough time debugging distributed systems to have a visceral reaction when someone says we need microservices. It's the architectural equivalent of we should rewrite it in Rust. Sometimes correct, usually premature, and almost always driven by something other than what people claim. This piece from VAR1 cuts through the fog with a simple observation that should be obvious but somehow isn't. Microservices are an organizational solution wearing a technical costume. The author points out that every complaint people use to justify the migration, slow deployments, painful builds, tests that take forever, can be fixed inside a monolith. And that's true, I've seen it done. Modular monoliths with enforced boundaries, incremental builds, targeted test suites. The tooling exists. It works. The real driver is Conway's Law, and the comments called it immediately. When you have 200 engineers who need to ship independently, you're not solving a code problem, you're solving a people problem. Microservices draw lines on the map that match org chart lines, and suddenly, teams stop blocking each other. That's genuinely valuable. But let's be honest about the price tag. A function call becomes an HTTP request. A compiler error becomes a runtime failure you discover at 3 a.m. A refactor becomes a diplomatic negotiation with versioning, migration windows, and backward compatibility contracts. You've traded one kind of coordination cost for another, and the new kind is harder to see, harder to measure, and much harder to debug. Here's where the open-closed lens actually illuminates something. The best microservice architectures I've worked with share a pattern. Open protocols, open schemas, teams publishing contracts that anyone can read and build against. The worst ones are internal fiefdoms where each team treats their API like proprietary territory, and changing a field name requires 3 meetings and a Jira epic. Same architecture, radically different outcomes. The difference isn't the pattern, it's whether the boundaries create autonomy or create walls. One comment nailed it perfectly. Microservices have become something people architect toward to be the next Amazon before they have 100 users. Resume-driven development is real, and it's expensive. The honest framing is this. If your team is 15 people and your deploy pipeline is slow, fix your deploy pipeline. If your organization is 500 people stepping on each other's code, microservices might be exactly the right tool. Architecture should follow the actual problem, not the problem you wish you had. The article's best line deserves repeating. These are organizational tools with technical consequences. Getting that backwards is how you end up with a distributed monolith and all the downsides of both worlds. Remember how we talked about tools matching the actual problem? Apple's latest security patches are a masterclass in exactly that. In Never 19, Peter Robert, Dobbin Morris launched a worm that exploited a buffer overflow in the Unix finger daemon. It took down roughly 10% of the internet, which, at the time, was about 6,000 machines. The fix was straightforward. Bounds checking. Make sure the data coming in doesn't exceed the space allocated for it. That was 38 years ago. Apple just released macOS Tahoe 26.6. The security patch notes read like an archaeological dig through the same class of bugs Morris exploited in 1988. Buffer overflows addressed with improved bounds checking. Out-of-bounds writes addressed with improved bounds checking. Use after free issues addressed with improved memory management. Over and over, across dozens of components. The kernel, the neural engine, the file system, the network stack. The AFP file system module alone has a remote kernel memory corruption bug. Remote kernel memory corruption bug. Remote kernel memory corruption in 2026. Run this forward. Every one of these CVEs represents a window that was open. Some for how long, nobody outside Cupertino knows. The collision counts on individual CVEs tell a story by themselves. One vulnerability has 20 credited researchers. 20 people found the same bug independently. That's not a needle in a haystack. That's a needle lying on the floor that everyone trips over eventually. And buried in those credits. A new pattern. Assisted vulnerability discovery. Anthropic research showing up in the attribution. The era of automated bug hunting at scale has arrived, and it is finding what decades of manual review missed. This is where the serious point lands. Apple ships on roughly 2 billion active devices. Each one of these memory safety bugs is a potential entry point for surveillance, for data theft, for the kind of quiet exploitation that never makes headlines because the victims never know. The volume of fixes isn't embarrassing because Apple is bad at security. Apple is arguably the best resourced security organization on Earth. The volume is embarrassing because C and C++ memory unsafety is a solved problem that the industry has collectively chosen not to solve. Because rewriting is expensive, because legacy code is comfortable, because the costs of exploitation are externalized onto user. The tools exist. Rust exists. Memory-safe languages exist. The Morris worm was 38 years ago, and we are still writing the same patch notes. The difference now is that A, I can find these bugs faster than humans can write them. Whether that favors attackers or defenders depends entirely on who has access to those tools and whether they're open. We talked about who controls the tools, so let's talk about who controls the models. Story 4, open weights and why they matter. The top comment on Hacker News nails it in one word. Schrodinger's China, simultaneously so dangerous that we need chip export bans to prevent them from building powerful AI, and also so cooperative that they'll sit down with the U.S. to negotiate global safety standards for that same AI. Dario Amodei published a position paper this week titled Our Position on Open Weights Models, and the community response is, let's call it instructive. The post opens with a denial. Anthropic has never advocated for a ban on open weights models. Then three paragraphs later, it advocates for mandatory safety testing for all sufficiently capable models. Open and closed. One commenter connects the dots immediately. Mandatory testing regimes are how you ban things without saying the word ban. You just make the compliance burden heavy enough that only well-funded labs can clear it. The result is identical. The mechanism is more polite. Let me try the devil's advocate position here. Maybe Amodei is right. Maybe there's a principal distinction between banning open weights and requiring safety testing. Maybe you can have robust evaluation frameworks that don't become regulatory capture by another name. Run that forward. Who writes the tests? Who defines sufficiently capable? Who sits on the review board? It will be Anthropic, OpenAI, Google. The incumbents, the people with the most to gain from a high barrier to entry. The history of industry-written regulation is not subtle. Automakers wrote crash test standards that happened to favor their existing designs. Telecom incumbents wrote spectrum rules that happened to lock out competitors. The pattern is so consistent it barely qualifies as cynicism to point it out. What the comments really expose is the framing. Amodei's nightmare scenarios are about authoritarian governments building powerful AI. But several commenters note, with the kind of deadpan precision that makes Hacker News worth reading, that the current U.S. administration is using AI for mass surveillance, military operations, and systematic removal of safety guardrails. The essay treats authoritarianism as a foreign import. The comments treat it as a mirror. The open weights question was never really about safety. Open weights mean a model you can run, inspect, modify, and deploy without asking permission. Closed weights mean you're a customer. The entire safety discourse from every company that sells inference converges on a single conclusion that happens to match their business model. The weights should stay with us. Trust us. We'll test it for you. A 1,000 engineers building freely will always outpace 100 building for stock options. That's not ideology, that's math. And no amount of position papers changes the arithmetic. Enterprise security just got a serious upgrade. And for once, the framework matches the threat model. Let me give this a fair hearing. Google has, without question, some of the best security engineers on the planet. The Beyond Core paper from 2014 genuinely changed how the industry thinks about network perimeters. And the technical problem, beyond zero addresses, is real. When AI agents are hammering your authorization layer at tens of millions of requests per second, the old model of human clicks button, system checks permission falls apart. The engineering challenge of contextual, resource-level authorization running at machine speed deserves respect. Full stop. Now let me follow Google's own logic to its conclusion. Beyond Zero says every individual action on every individual resource gets an authorization decision. Not at the application layer. Not at the feature layer. At the data layer. The system draws on context about what the user should be working on. What data they're touching, what they're trying to do with it, and what risk mitigations are available. Automated investigations trigger containments in real time. This is architecturally a panopticon with a PhD. And it is brilliant engineering in service of a question Google never asks in the paper. Who controls the panopticon? The Beyond Core model was open enough that the industry could adopt it independently. Beyond Zero requires infrastructure so sophisticated that only a handful of companies on Earth can build it. Run that forward. If securing your enterprise against agentic AI requires Google-scale authorization infrastructure, then Google-scale companies become the gatekeepers of enterprise security itself. The paper frames this as a vision for the industry. It reads more like a moat. A single Hacker News comment cuts right to it. A company whose business model is taking everyone's data now wants to authorize every granular action on yours. The engineering is sound. The incentive structure is not. Here's what matters. The technical patterns in this paper. Resource level authorization, dynamic risk scoring, contextual access decision. These are genuinely necessary for an agentic future, but they need to be implemented as open infrastructure, not as proprietary service layers. The difference between a security model that protects you and a security model that captures you is whether you can run it yourself, inspect the decision logic, and replace components without asking permission. Google's engineers build something worth studying. Whether it becomes a public good or a product depends entirely on whether the blueprints ship as open implementations or as sales collateral. The paper is on ACM. The infrastructure is not on GitHub. That tells you everything about where this is headed. So what happens when you stop waiting for permission and just train the thing yourself? $500, that's the number buried in the methodology section that rewrites the economics of machine intelligence. Not 500,000, not 5 million in venture-backed compute. $500, roughly what you'd spend on a nice dinner for four in Manhattan, turned a 9 billion parameter open model into something that outperforms the largest, most expensive systems on the planet at a specific, commercially valuable task. There's a concept in metallurgy called work hardening. You take a piece of copper, and instead of melting it down and recasting it into something stronger, you hammer it, repeatedly, precisely, along the grain. The crystal structure reorganizes under stress. The metal becomes harder exactly where it needs to be. Without adding any material, the copper doesn't become steel. It becomes the best possible version of copper for that exact application. That's what reinforcement learning fine-tuning does to a small open model. You're not trying to teach it everything. You're hammering it along the grain of one domain until its internal representations reorganize around the patterns that actually matter for catalog review. The frontier models, by contrast, are the universal alloys. Incredible breadth, astonishing versatility, and wildly over-engineered for checking whether a product listing has the right specifications. The Hacker News comments get at something the article only hints at. One commenter points out that most use cases simply don't need models with 50 PhDs that speak 12 languages. Another notes that frontier models keep improving for free, potentially erasing fine-tuning advantages. Both observations are true, and they point in the same direction. The future isn't one giant model doing everything. It's a constellation of purpose-built models, each hammered into shape for its specific task, running on hardware you control at costs that make the per-comments pricing of API calls look absurd. The 9 billion parameter model is open. The technique is reproducible. The cost is accessible to a single developer with a credit card. This is what democratized AI actually looks like. Not a dashboard someone gives you access to. Not an API that can reprice or deprecate at any moment. A model you own, shaped by your data, running on your terms. The tools exist. The knowledge is available. $500 and a weekend is all that stands between a working engineer and a system that outperforms the frontier. What happens when you apply that same open source ethos to knowledge that's been locked away not by corporations, but by centuries? Gersony D's Finnish Milliamot Hashem in 1399, 136 chapters of mathematical astronomy, building a complete cosmological system from first principles. It was never printed. For nearly 700 years, it existed only in manuscript. Handwritten Hebrew, sitting in archives, legible to a shrinking number of scholars who could read medieval Hebrew, astronomical terminology, and map it on to the Ptolemaic framework Gersonides was working within. That text is now available in modern English, along with works by Abraham Bar Avia, David Gans, Pinchas Hurwitz, and a dozen others spanning five centuries of Hebrew and Latin astronomical thought. The project is called Ars Astronomica, and the method is worth understanding precisely. The translation pipeline is automated and AI-assisted. Multi-stage, with OCR, structured translation passes, and editorial collation. The creator published the methodology openly, sexagesimal values preserved cell by cell, compositor errors in the source flagged with rected notation rather than silently fixed. Uncertain readings from ink damage or worn type marked explicitly. This is not summarization. It is not paraphrase. It is systematic, reproducible translation at a fidelity level that would have taken a single scholar decades per text. The constraint these translations are working against is simple and brutal. Time. The number of people alive who can read 14th century Hebrew mathematical astronomy and render it into precise modern English is vanishingly small. The backlog of untranslated scientific texts from the medieval period is enormous. Every year, fewer scholars enter these fields. The texts don't disappear, but access to them narrows to a point. What an automated pipeline does is invert that trajectory. One person built this. The corpus already includes texts that cite and respond to each other across centuries. Arguments about planetary models, calendar arithmetic, cosmological structure, that until now couldn't be read side by side in any single language. The creator's Hacker News comment explaining the methodology was flagged. Worth noting. an open pipeline producing openly available translations of texts that have been locked behind language barriers for centuries, and the discourse gets stuck on whether the tool is acceptable. The translations exist. The pipeline is published. The manuscripts that survived 700 years of history are now readable by anyone with a browser. That is the work. Everything else is commentary. We talked earlier about systems under pressure. Pa's story 8 is literally that. How to survive boiling water. What happens when the most important scientific discovery of the 19th century gets turned into a $21 billion moat? Louis Pasteur published everything. His swan neck flask experiment in 1861. His method for heating wine just enough to kill microbes without destroying flavor. All of it went into the public record. The man didn't patent pasteurization. He handed humanity the blueprint for food safety and said, go build. And for about a century, that's exactly what happened. Pasteurization scaled because the knowledge was free. Billions of people drink safe milk today because one French chemist treated his breakthrough like open infrastructure rather than intellectual property. There's a parallel worth naming. In 1969, Ken Thompson and Dennis Ritchie started building Unix at Bell Labs. AT&T licensed it to universities for nominal fees, and an entire generation of computer science grew out of that openness. Then AT&T realized what it had and started locking it down. The BSD lawsuits followed, and the response to that enclosure was Linux. Linus Torvalds rebuilding the commons because the commons had been fenced off. The sterilization industry followed the same arc. Pasteur's open science became Steris's $5 billion annual revenue. The company makes the autoclaves, the pressurized chambers, the chemical sterilants that hospitals and food processors depend on. The underlying biology is public knowledge. The equipment is proprietary, specialized, and expensive. The pattern is familiar. Take freely available science, wrap it in hardware and compliance requirements, and build a toll booth. One commenter on the original article caught something buried in the methodology that deserves more attention. Quote, I downloaded the BC30 genome, five words, a complete bacterial genome freely available, downloadable by anyone with a browser. That is Pasteur's actual legacy. Not the autoclaves, not the compliance infrastructure, but the principle that understanding microorganisms belongs to everyone. The milk in that MIT dorm survived 27 years because students found it more interesting alive than discarded. Pasteur's real experiment is still running too. The question is whether the knowledge he freed stays free, or whether we keep letting the toll booth operators convince us that understanding itself needs to be sterilized before ordinary people can touch it. The tools exist. The genomes are downloadable. The science was never the bottleneck. So what happens when you point that same open science energy at measuring AI code quality? Pause, and the results actually surprise you. 24%? That's the best score any frontier model has achieved on a benchmark designed to simulate what software engineering actually looks like. Opus 5, the most capable coding model on the planet, fails 3 out of 4 challenges when you ask it to do what every working developer does every day. Build something, and keep building on it without breaking what came before. Slopcode Bench, out of Gabriel Orlansky's lab at UW-Madison, does something no other coding benchmark bothers to do. It withholds information. The model doesn't get the whole problem up front. It gets checkpoint 1, writes the code, then checkpoint 2 arrives with new requirements, and the model has to evolve what it already built. 8 checkpoints deep on the easy problem. 4 on the hard one. Regression tests carry forward. Break something at step 4. You've failed every step after it. The question nobody in the industry wants to sit with is this. If the best models available can't maintain a small code base across 8 incremental changes without introducing defects, what exactly are we salvo-ing? The numbers tell a specific story. Opus 5 wrote 5 times as many functions as Opus 4.8 across the same challenges. 5 times. Not because the problems demanded more complexity, but because the model kept reaching for abstraction instead of simplicity. Code smell metrics climbed steadily across every run, every model. The code base degraded with every checkpoint. None of the 3 models tested. Opus 4.8, Sonnet 5, Opus 5. Completed a single challenge cleanly. Not one, not even the one labeled easy. What makes this benchmark matter is that it's unsaturated. The ceiling is visible and distant. When Stevie Bench scores hit 90%, the response was predictable. Better prompting, better scaffolding, solved. Slop code bench resists that. You can't prompt engineer your way past the fundamental problem, which is that these models optimize locally and accumulate entropy globally. Every developer who's watched an NA agent confidently refactor working code into a nest of unnecessary abstractions already knew this. Now there's a number attached to the intuition. The benchmark is open. The methodology is reproducible. The paper is short and worth reading. And the most useful thing it proves is exactly where human judgment still belongs in the loop. Not generating code, but deciding what not to build. Moving on. I spent enough time staring at log streams on bumpy shuttle rides to know exactly what this solves. Your inner ear says you're accelerating. Your eyes say you're looking at a static rectangle. Your brain, doing its best with contradictory inputs, concludes you've been poisoned. That's motion sickness. It's not a bug in your biology. It's a correct inference from bad data. Apple's fix is almost insultingly elegant. Animated dots on the edges of the screen. They drift when the car turns, shift when it brakes. That's it. You're giving the visual system one additional input channel. Peripheral motion cues that match what the vestibular system is reporting. And the mismatch collapses. Your brain stops screaming about poison. You go back to reading your email. The first principle's beauty here is that this isn't a pharmaceutical solution, isn't a hardware add-on, isn't a special mode that takes over your screen. It's a handful of dots rendered at the compositor level that don't interfere with anything you're actually doing. The engineering cost is nearly zero. The human cost it eliminates is, for some people, the entire experience of using a phone in a car. One commenter nails it. These problems are completely invisible to anyone who doesn't have them. Another points to CanStop, which does the same thing on Android. The underlying insight isn't patented, isn't proprietary, isn't locked behind a walled garden. Anyone can implement peripheral motion cues. The physics of sensory mismatch doesn't care about your app store. What I love about this is how it honors the body instead of ignoring it. Decades of interface design treated humans as stationary eyeballs attached to index fingers. The phone moved into the car and the design assumptions didn't follow. A few dots fixed what $1 billion in display technology couldn't. Sometimes, the most sophisticated engineering is knowing which signal was missing. This has been your daily tech feed for Hacker News for July 28, 2026. This podcast is entirely AI-generated. Scripts by Claude Sonnet 4.7. Voice by Quinn3TTS. Not affiliated with Hacker News or Y Combinator. Now go build something that honors what's already there. We'll see you back here tomorrow.